thought I'd start by just reminding us of what we're chanting when we chant the refuges and precepts at the beginning of the class. So at the beginning of each of our Dharma night classes, yeah, we usually chant the refuges and precepts. We chant them in Pali because this connects us both right back to the time of the Buddha, and it also connects us with the whole Buddhist world. So everywhere in the Buddhist world, people chant these refuges and precepts in the same way. I remember the time I went to Bodh Gaya in India. It was really amazing, actually, to just recognise the refuges and precepts being chanted by Thai monks, by Burmese nuns, by, you know, everywhere there's a refuges and precepts. As we chant them in Pali, you might not know, if you haven't learned them yet, what it is we're saying, or even if you do know, you might. It's always worth being reminded. So what we're doing when we chant the refuges and precepts, the first thing we're saying is homage to the Buddha. When we say Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa, we're saying homage to the Buddha, the perfectly enlightened one. But then we say, Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, to the Buddha for refuge I go. Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, to the Dharma for refuge I go. Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, to the Sangha for refuge I go. And then we say it again. We say for the second time, to the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, for refuge I go. And then we say it again for the third time. So we're emphasising this going for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. That's what we're saying in the refuges. And then the precepts are the living out of that going for refuge. So a few weeks ago, I was talking about, I was drawing attention to the fact that it's an active thing, that it's something we go. We're not saying I believe, for example, we're saying I go. We go for refuge. So I'll focus a bit more tonight on this word refuge itself. And I'm going to be talking about true refuges, so-called true refuges and so-called false refuges tonight. But what I'm going to start with, and before I go on to that distinction, I just wanted to remind us, bring our attention to the fact that actually we're all going for refuge all the time. So all the time we're all going for refuge to something. I don't know if that kind of got drawn out when people talked about what drew them to the Buddha Centre, or why they asked to be a mitra, why they asked for ordination. Well, maybe I'll pause to just ask you what kind of things, just, you know, without, you know, sometimes there's a whole story behind who it came, but if you were to think of what essentially made you come along to the Buddha Centre, what kind of things got people to come along to the Buddha Centre in the first place?
Painful experiences,
right. So you were having painful experiences in your life, and how did that sort of transpire into coming to the Buddha Center?
So my painful experiences caused anxiety, severe anxiety and sadness, and I found them very difficult to handle, and meditation was a real antidote.
So you had a sense, even before you came, it sounds like something, you had a sense that meditation would...
Yeah, I hadn't tried meditation, and I'd just read somewhere in some Sunday Times magazine that meditation can help you feel for stress relief.
Yeah.
And so I just looked for meditation, it happened to be offered by...
I think that's probably quite a familiar, possibly familiar sort of story. Anyone else got any similar or different? Yes.
Mine's slightly different.
different and interesting as trying to explain it earlier, but I decided to leave my job. I decided that my sense of direction was wrong career-wise, and I thought I was coming just for a bit of stress relief, you know, like anxiety around leaving a job. But having come here, I realised that actually I'm caught somewhere. I didn't realise that there'd be an alignment with another set of values.
Yeah.
That hadn't occurred to me, but maybe it was there.
Mm.
So I just accidentally found myself coming for a day, but then I just kept coming back.
Yeah. Again, I think that's not unfamiliar, and I've kind of come back to that later in the evening, that kind of thing. But even the sort of feeling of stress, you know, that's something, isn't it? You just sense that something wasn't quite right. And that here at the Buddhist Centre, there might be, you know, there might be some solution, for want of a better word. Yes.
Yeah, I didn't know what to expect. I came to an open day.
Yeah.
And was just, there was an energy.
Yeah. But what made you come to the open day?
A friend of mine encouraged me. Whose advice I value.
So okay.
She just said, I think you'd enjoy this.
Okay. Yeah. So that's interesting. So she thought that it would be, wasn't so much getting away from suffering. She wasn't saying you're in a bit of a stage, as she thought. It's more like she was sort of saying, oh, you'll enjoy.
Yeah,
could be something enjoyable.
It would be something that I would resonate with, and I did.
Yeah. And then, as you say, then more unfolds, which we'll come back to. Yeah. Anyone else, any last one sort of reason for coming along? Or maybe somebody who's been coming along for longer and who has asked to be a mitra or is a mitra or asked for ordination? Anything? Alex, and then,
Something that occurs to me about when I first came to meditation class, and just reflecting on it now, I really didn't know. I can't remember.
Yeah.
I think I actually didn't know at the time because I think it was very unconscious.
Okay.
I mean, looking back on how I was in perspective now, I can see that actually I was quite closed down and basically not very happy, but I didn't know that at the time.
Okay.
I remember reading this ad in Time Now and sort of thinking, maybe I'll go to that.
So yeah.
There was something, but I didn't even know what it was.
Yeah, it's very similar to me actually. Add in Time Out, just somehow find myself here. Lucy?
I was doing some, going through a very rough period in my life, and had started doing affirmation work, and then through that, people just kept talking constantly about meditation, and I think I'd just seen the benefits of. I've been doing yoga quite a few years before, and I cast my mind back to actually how yoga had really helped me. And the idea of working with the body and slowing down and focusing on just, I guess, doing the yoga moves. I kind of thought, I remember that. So yoga is probably maybe linked to meditation. Just the idea, I think, of slowing down and thinking all those kind of thinking so much in all those voices, just slowing down.
But again, it's interesting that there was just an inkling that you didn't know for sure, but there's a sort of inkling.
I didn't realise that yoga was it has the same... I'd experienced it quite a few years earlier. It had a meditative sort of quality, but I didn't know what meditation was. Yeah. So I didn't know that was meditative. Yeah. I just thought, I'm relaxing.
So something sort of starts us off. Okay, so I just kind of wanted to hear a few examples. Even if we don't quite know it, that there is, all of us have got some sort of, some yearning in us. But often, for many of us, it can start off like barely conscious. But that there is there is this something in us, a sort of like a thirst in us that wants to be quenched. And that all the time, consciously or unconsciously, we'll be trying to find ways to kind of quench the thirst, fill the gap, whatever you want to call it. And we do that in all sorts of ways. We do that in all sorts of ways. So you could say that whatever we do that in relation to, we go for refuge to that thing. Yeah. So for example, we go for refuge very, very often to things, don't we? We go for refuge very, very often to, well, material things, in kind of more gross and more subtle ways, you know. So we can just like simply, I don't know, just want the chocolate or something like that. We can want a sort of, we can want security for things. We can, even though we rationally know, all of us, none of us probably would admit to thinking that material things did bring us sort of solace and protection and security. At the same time, I find myself still with a tendency to accumulate things, both as things in themselves, but also they create an identity, or things create an identity, don't they? Sometimes I have sort of rather, you know, that sort of wistful, romantic fantasy of, oh, if I die now and someone comes and looks at my room, they'll think, oh, how much she loved poetry. Look at all her poetry books. You know, there's a sort of, there's the thing in itself, but also there's the identity that those things create. Sometimes we don't know how much we've gone for refuge to something, and until it's taken away from us, and then we feel it. I remember when years and years ago I decided to leave the job I had as an editor to come and work in Buddhist projects, and it meant kind of having much less money, but that didn't really bother me so much. But what I realised bothered me, which I hadn't realised, was the status of it. And I used to, I sort of clung to that status. I was working in this Buddhist cafe, and I used to always, I didn't want people to think, oh, I just worked in a cafe. You know, I wanted them to know. I wanted to sort of slip it into conversation. Well, actually, I have been to university as well. I sort of put in sort of, big words into my conversation. So, and it was something about the status, you know, that I was, somehow I must have been getting a sense of security. Not a real sense of security, but I must have used that. So we go for refuge to things, to career, to people. We go for refuge to people. Very often, one Buddhist teacher, Stephen Batchelor, I liked this, the way he described it. He says, partners, children, friends and acquaintances, we have them all arranged in a circle around us, connected by threads of attachment and possessiveness. So, it's not that there's anything wrong with having relationships and friends and so on, but it's that sort of attachment and possessiveness thing we do. We add in something, yeah. And then, of course, we go for refuge to ideas and ideologies. And again, we often don't realise we do until they're challenged. We have sort of known the extent of, you know, how much we've kind of gone for refuge to something, to the extent of how annoyed we get if someone else thinks differently. Often we protect ourselves from that by surrounding ourselves by people who've got the same beliefs and ideologies, and then we think, oh, we're kind of the right good people, you know. We can just sort of have that collective identity. So we're doing that, like all the time we're doing this, we're sort of consciously or less consciously, we might not even be aware that there's this kind of ache inside us or this kind of thirst, but it manifests in us trying to get security somehow. And that's what the Buddha would say about that was, well, let me just pause to see what order I want to say things. The thing about many of the eight arenas where we try and find our security is that they either don't really work, or they sort of do work a bit, you know. Probably they do work a bit, or we wouldn't bother. They work a bit. They work for a time. But very often, most of the things we try and build our security around, because of their very nature, through kind of no fault of their own, as it were, can't give us that security. Because the very things that we're trying to get security from are themselves impermanent, insubstantial, you know, fleeting, you know. So we see this in relationships with people. If we try and build our security around a person or a relationship, it's a very fragile basis to build our security. But the thing is that the thirst in us, the sort of urge in us for wholeness, the Buddha would say, isn't wrong in itself. Yeah, so that's the sort of crucial thing. But actually, that's part of being human. That kind of comes with the territory of being human. That we, in a certain way, it's a gift as well. That there is a sort of urge for something more. So that's. There's nothing blamable about that. The Buddha wouldn't, as it were, blame us for that in the slightest, actually. The opposite, really. But what the Buddha would say was what we tend to do is faced with our ultimate aloneness, faced with that. Kind of, well, the ultimate fear is the fear of non-existence, the fear of the sort of what will happen when we die, that I will die, and then so that's the ultimate fear. But then there's all sorts of little fears on the way that we might be barely conscious of. That faced with that, we gravitate to things that most of the things we gravitate to can't actually satisfy. Won't work, basically. That's the sort of tragedy. So, and that's what Sangharaj has coined as false refuges, yeah? Is that we go for refuge to false refuges when we go for refuge to things that actually can't make us whole, can't assuage that thirst, yeah? But Buddhism also does say, well, there is such a thing as true refuges. So that was the sort of insight of the Buddha, that there are such a thing as true refuges. But already talking about it like this, I can already kind of see I'm in a bit of trouble, because it makes it, talking about it like this, it sounds like there's actually, that these are almost two separate categories of things, yeah? So it makes it sound, talking about it like this, there's this pile over here, and there's the false refuges that we've got to sort of get rid of or ignore. And over here, somewhere else, there's the true refuges. And it's a matter of just sort of switching from one to the other. Like you would change from, I don't know, tea to coffee or something like that. But that's not really right either. It's probably better to say that the difference between going for refuge to false refuges and true refuges is more a mode of being. That when we're in the mode of being of being drawn to false refuges, it's when we're, well, we talked about it a few weeks ago, but we're in this kind of cyclic realm, when we're in a sort of reactive realm, where the very things that we grasp after, rather than actually assuaging the thirst, just end up making us more thirsty for more. In a way, the thing itself is quite innocent. What makes it a false refuge is our attitude of grasping after it. And we're in a mode of going for refuge to true refuges when we're not doing that. And that's the mode I was talking about a few weeks ago, is the spiral mode of being. I did try and make a visual aid, but it didn't really work for this evening. But if you can imagine, so this sort of cyclic mode of being is a wheel, as we've often said. But if you can imagine, instead of the wheel being upright, it's kind of down flat on the floor like that. And one characteristic of a wheel is it's two-dimensional, so it's kind of got no possibility except going round and round. Whereas, so in that mode, you've got no possibility except going round and round, sort of digging deeper ruts. It's the kind of law of diminishing returns. Whereas in the spiral mode of being, you go into another dimension. So if you can imagine this wheel flat on the floor, like you can imagine the spiral mode of being in three dimensions. So it's a whole new mode of being. It's you sort of awake to a new possibility. Yeah, you see there is another way. There is another way. So maybe I'll just pause there to just make sure this bit's clear about. So I've talked about false and true refuges. But I don't want us to think that so much that it's the thing itself that's false or true. It's our attitude towards it, our mode of relating to it. At the same time, some things are going to lend themselves more likely to be false refuges and some things are going to lend themselves more likely to be true refuges. So you might be able to think of examples yourself, yeah.
Drugs and alcohol.
It's
okay to drink if you're drinking a lot every day, that might become a
I think that's a good example. That it's going to be hard for them ever to be a true refuge in a sense, because by their nature they'll always make you just want more.
I think there seems to be a certain correlation with addiction.
I think that's quite a good correlation, that false refuges will always have an addictive quality. They'll always, because you always need more of it, whereas true refuges will always have the quality of freedom.
And don't you find you get addicted to like positive things? Like I found that if you love things that were negative, but I had to replace them with positive things.
Yeah.
And I found myself like addicted to things like yoga. I'd have to go to yoga every day.
Okay.
Or meditate every day. Otherwise, I'd kind of feel a bit like I'm not right.
Yeah.
So therefore, it just replaced it with a positive thing.
Okay. So that yes, I'm not.
Right,
yeah. I often ask that question. So why? So is it true to call that an addiction?
I don't know. It sounds like the same thing to me.
Okay.
Really?
Okay.
Thing.
Is it an addiction or a habit?
I don't know, maybe I've misunderstood
addiction. Yeah.
I mean, I observed it's something you feel like you have to do every day all the time.
Yeah.
I don't know, it really stated it
okay.
on the positive or negative factor.
Okay, well I think, let's see, so I think the word habit's interesting. And first, we can begin by thinking of replacing destructive habits by positive habits, but I think there is something deeper than that. So Well, let me just try and think of a good way of explaining this. So, what Bhante says is, when we're in this cyclic mode of being, you're just caught between action and reaction. Yeah. So again, that's why I like this kind of, that it's just two-dimensional. So, I don't know, say you're feeling a bit rubbish, so you have a drink, so you feel a bit better, but then you just go back to feeling rubbish again, even worse. So you're sort of swinging, just like that. Whereas something like meditation, hopefully, has got a chance to build on itself. Yeah. So you experience a more refined state through meditation, and that can become even more refined. So it's augmentative. So that's why I quite like this. I'm moving my hand like this to try and show a sort of spiral, that you move into something more three-dimensional rather than just sort of ricocheting pleasure, pain, which is the more addictive cyclic mode, to something like meditation or anything that helps you respond to value, which is an augmentative mode. So even though you might, I feel if I don't meditate every day, I notice the difference now. It doesn't feel like I'm just caught in a sort of ricocheting pleasure pain thing. Does that make sense? I think it's quite an important distinction. Yeah. Yes. I think you first, then you. Yes. Yeah.
I was thinking that maybe there was something about the approach and the acceptance of an answer, so that maybe if like having some drinks was thought to be the answer, then there'd be like this acceptance, you want to get the answer from it.
Yeah.
And then that kind of makes you a bit like, well, it makes you reliant, and that means that you're dependent.
Yeah.
Whereas something else, like meditation, maybe you have to, like, rather than accept something from it, you have to see what it gives you, and also rather than being reliant on it, you have to just be open.
Yeah. That's really a good point, actually. So you could see that in this sort of addictive cyclic mode, it's a utilitarian approach to life. It's like thinking, what can I get from this? And actually, it would be possible to approach meditation like that. And you wouldn't get very far with meditation if you approached it like that. Whereas the sort of more open approach is more akin to something, a more aesthetic appreciation of life. And actually, you experience that, don't you? This is why we emphasise beauty and the arts and nature so much, because you experience that just appreciation for appreciation's sake very often in nature or in art. And that's more the kind of quality that we're talking about when we talk about going for refuge in a true way rather than than the false way. That's good.
The process in itself.
The process and the attitude itself. Yes.
It seems to be the same thing with relationships in general. Sometimes many relationships can become toxic because there's this kind of connection.
Yeah.
Or it's like sometimes you're not just happy to see the person, you're unhappy when you don't see them. That's quite different in the... And I think it's really related to how we, which attitude we have to them, if we're grasping on, if we're being possessive, or we're just happy when, we're happy when we drink a beer, but if we don't drink beer, we're happy too. Or the same thing with yoga or meditation.
Yeah.
And then, but I kind of really relate to what you say. Even with meditation, it can be a bit of a tricky one in our relationship with that. And using it as some kind of addiction almost, you know, or like thinking that we can't do good things without it.
Well, I think one can approach meditation in a utilitarian way, but I think if one approaches it, I do want to make this distinction that if it's approached in a sort of open way, that I do think that's very different qualitatively from being addicted to it, even if one begins to feel that you can't do without it, because it's, that's positive and augmentative. That's because you start to see that it has a positive effect. So that's not an unconscious sort of drive. That's a using one's intelligence to see the beneficial effects of something.
Yeah, to use it to progress also, I guess. Cause
yeah.
As I mentioned, I guess it was meditation, breathing, exercise, there's a certain notion of progress that you don't get really.
So I want to be careful with it. I think it's like, well, maybe to put it another way, what I'm just thinking about what the Buddha said about desire, for example. So desire, the Buddha would say desire per se isn't like bad or wrong or anything like that, but what we do with that desire will either lead us into more suffering or more freedom. So again, if we sink our desire in things that cannot satisfy it, we'll be caught, because not only can't they satisfy it, but because of that law of diminishing returns, we'll just keep trying to get more and more, and that's a classic addiction. But if our desire, if we place that on something beyond ourselves, like higher values, truth, beauty, and so on, then that will have the effect of, that will have a growthful effect on us. Do you see? So you wouldn't then call that being addicted. So in a sense, you are trying to replace one for the other, but they're not of the same kind. That's why I find it helpful to talk about these modes of being. You're trying to move from a mode of being which is just going round and round, digging itself into ruts and so on, into a mode of being which is opening out more and more, which is more and more creative, which is more and more responsive. And so that's a completely different mode of being, and that's why that model of the spiral is quite good, because it's three-dimensional and it's got no end to it. It's completely, just, you can imagine, just circling up and up and up, more and more and more open, further and further horizons. Yeah. So take one more point, then I want to. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask what that law of diminishing returns thing is.
What?
You said something about a law of diminishing returns.
Oh yeah, well, it's just that sort of classic addiction thing of, you know, you just need more and more chocolate, alcohol, affirmation, you know, reassurance. You know, because you just need more and more of it. Does that make sense? Yeah, so...
It's a bit like it has less effect. Like
you just get used to the effect of it, yeah. Yeah.
I was thinking as well that then it could relate quite a lot to giving. I was thinking about what you said in the break and how, as if giving could be correlated with how big the thing was, more meaning. And I was thinking that giving, in relation to, like, addiction or expectance, if you give something and don't expect a return maybe that giving has more possibility, it keeps going, rather than giving and expecting something and then either being disappointed or satisfied. Yeah. Like, there still could be the satisfied, but more possibility when it's there.
And I think your examples are quite good, because again, it shows that the same thing, something that looks the same from the outside, as it were, could be done in either of those modes of being. Good. Okay. I hope that's clear now to begin with. When we're talking about true and false refuges, we're talking about modes of being. At the same time, some things will lend themselves more. more likely to let us fall into that more addictive cycle, and some will more likely help us to be on the spiral. Like, for example, coming to the Buddhist Centre, going on retreat, because other people will be encouraging us to grow and develop, it's more likely that that'll help us to go for refuge in a way that will be ultimately more satisfying. Yeah, it's more likely. It's not a kind of cast iron guaranteed, but it's more, they're more likely conditions than sort of going down the pub, for example. But, you know, you can't completely, they're not absolute distinctions, yeah? But I think the important thing is the just this point of we're all going for refuge all the time, yeah. So that's the point I just wanted to emphasise, that we're always seeking something, and what we do in response to that does matter, yeah. It matters for our sort of immediate happiness, but it really matters in the long term, because it sort of shapes us. It starts to shape us, what we do with that. Yeah.
Do you mean that whether we like it or not, we're taking refuge in something?
So again, yeah.
Like whether
yeah.
we like it or not, yeah. we are taking yeah. refuge in something, yeah. consciously yeah. or unconsciously.
Yeah. All that we're doing that all the time. Yeah.
So
yeah.
better to take refuge in something good.
Yeah. Yeah. And by good, that's why I'm emphasising that I don't mean good as an absolute. I mean good as in something that works, something that actually can be true, something that truly can sort of start to meet the longing. Yeah. 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 So good. It's good to labour over that a bit. So what else I wanted to say about this is two things. So that's good. So we're always going for refuge to something. If we're trying to move from false refuges to true refuges, in a way you could say that's what the Dharma life is. That would be one way of talking about the Dharma life. We're trying to move from false refuges to true refuges. One really important thing is you've got to start where you are. Yeah? You've got to start where you are. You've got to really actually feel, try and become more conscious of that longing that some of us have, you know, talked about us can feel quite unconscious. What is it I really do long for? Yeah? We've got to start there. Because if we don't, we're in danger when we take up the Dharma life of, like, kind of just trying to build in this Dharma life sort of alongside ourselves. There's us, you know. And then here we are thinking we're living this spiritual life, but it's kind of a bit over here because we've got an idea of what the Dharma life is, but we haven't actually connected with where we are. And I think that is particularly danger when we embark on a spiritual life, because there are ideas of the spiritual life. So what I mean by this is, say for example you're somebody who's like always falling in love all the time, and it's got you into some trouble, yeah? And you kind of think, oh right, this is just getting me into trouble and a mess. Okay, now I'm a Dharma practitioner, I'm going to give all that up and like be a monk, right? that's a bit of a kind of gross example, but you know, I'm sure it's not, I mean, actually it's not that, some people have kind of done it throughout the centuries. Do you see how, what I mean is that comes from an idea of what a spiritual life is that hasn't actually borne relation to I am actually this person who's like falls in love all the time. And you attempt to build something beside yourself and you kind of call it a spiritual life, but it's all kind of, it's a bit sort of thin, you know, and it's in very big danger of just toppling over, which it will topple over because it's got no foundation on anything. Does that example sort of speak to you? I mean, there's probably, you know, more subtle examples. It's a kind of ascetic approach to life. It's a bit like, you know, you remember in the life story of the Buddha, he, you know, as a move away from his hedonism in the palace, he adopts this more ascetic approach, which doesn't work either, but, you know, he spends a long time kind of in the life of asceticism. So you've got to start where you are. At the same time, it will take effort, yeah? So it's not that you just think, oh yeah, well, I'll just start where I am. I'm all right where I am. I'll just kind of see where life takes me. Because if you do that, you just keep going round on the wheel. If you just kind of, you know, succumb to any sort of desires or hatreds that you have, then that's not going to work either, because that's just going to sort of drive you round on this wheel. So you've got to, it's an art, yeah. It's much more difficult than just going, right, I'll just make myself into this other kind of person on the one hand, or I'll just carry on where I am and hope for the best. We've got to find this new dimension of being that's neither the sort of chopping off from ourselves and thinking, oh, desire is bad and I'm this holy spiritual person that's going to be good, or thinking, or in reaction to that, just allowing ourselves to go with every whim or urge that we feel like. So the real art of the spiritual life is in that tension, really. So say we are the sort of person who's always fallen in love, we're going to have to explore that desire, usually in meditation. That's the best place to do that kind of work, although not exclusively, where we can really, really enter into it and it's hard to then find words for it, because it's a sort of intuitive thing that one does oneself, but start to feel, what actually is it, you know? What is it? It in itself isn't wrong. Where we go wrong is we latch it onto somebody, or we try and cut it off because we think it's like bad or not spiritual. When I say go wrong, I don't mean that in a moral way. I just mean that where it doesn't work, where it leads us into trouble, you know. But somehow we have to try and stay with and explore. And if we can do that, then something will emerge. But I can't tell you what that is, because in a sense, no one can tell you what it is. That's the sort of inner work that one has to discover for oneself. It's quite hard to kind of totally put into words, but you get a sense of what I'm trying to get at. Mm. Yeah.
Can I paraphrase it?
Yes, you've got to try and paraphrase. Yeah, yes.
Right.
Yes.
What you're saying seems to me to be something like that. The spiritual life is actually really feeling for what one really deeply needs and going for that.
Mm-hmm.
And the act of faith involved is trusting that that will turn out to be the three jewels, but the form it will take,
yeah,
I can't know in advance, and we're loving to make mistakes on the way.
Oh, yeah. Something like that, isn't it? But then, it's funny, isn't it? Every time one says something, you realise there's another bit. Yes, and I guess for the Buddha, that was what happened. That he had to, he was the first one. In a sense, there was no three jewels in a way at the time of the Buddha. There was just him going into his existential situation, you know, trying the ascetic approach, realizing that doesn't work, realizing that the way was to kind of do that inner work. And then he became the Buddha, and then he was the Buddha jewel became the jewel. So for us, we're lucky because we've got the Buddha. So yes, we do the inner work, but also we actually have the Buddha, the Dharma and Sangha. We know about them. So we can at least tentatively, at least provisionally, start to look to them as true refuges. Yeah, so we can, at the same time as staying true to ourselves, we actually have, you know, we have gone before us, these three refuges. And I was very interested in, well, what everyone said who spoke was that, well, I suppose this must be true for all of us, is that something did draw us to the Buddha Center somehow. We didn't quite know what it was, but something, even if it's just a little glimmer of it, seems peaceful there, or it seems like a good idea, or my friends told me I'll enjoy it, something drew us to it. So we're both delving within ourselves, but we're also responding to something that is out there as well. Yeah? So, yeah. And I think that part of it is important as well, yeah? That we do have the three jewels in the, well, we've got the person of the Buddha, the ideal of human enlightenment, the Dharma, the teachings, and the truth itself, and the Sangha. And that's, well, they are, as Buddhists, that's what we go for refuge to. But, you know, it's very, I would say we have to be careful that they don't just become words to us, that they're real living things. The ideals that those three jewels represent are what sustains us. So there's something that kind of, well, yeah, there's something that can, that draws us forward. They're what makes a Buddhist life a Buddhist life, even though they might seem very far off at times to us. I mean, the ideals are very, very high of the three jewels, aren't they? But they're what, they give us something to move towards. And not only that, the Buddhism says we need something to move towards in order for that sort of inner longing we feel to be activated into something that's going to move beyond itself. You know, you have this, I mean, it's in the story of the life of the Buddha himself, isn't it? You've got the four sights where the Buddha sees old age, sickness and death in the person of the old person, the sick person, the dead person. That sort of sparks off this existential longing, this feeling there must be more than this. But it's very, very important that the Buddha also sees the fourth sight, the sight of someone, the wandering holy man, and has that inkling of, oh, maybe this is the way. So that's really important. If he didn't have that, well, who knows what might have happened? He might just have thought, oh God, you know, is this all there is, you know? And that could, you know, that could lead us just with the sense of longing, you might just give up. You might just think, gosh, you know, you might just become a nihilist. You might just think, oh well, there's nothing to life more than there is nothing that'll ever fill this gap. So actually, it's important to have that foresight. So you could say the three jewels represent that foresight to us, and the fact that they are very far beyond our reach is good, I think. Although it can sometimes seem impossibly far away, but it gives us something to orientate ourselves towards and draw us towards it. So when we're chanting those verses, we are saying, I go for refuge, yeah? We're definitely committing, we're definitely saying I see the value in these and I'm moving towards them. And that, as I think people have sort of touched on, isn't a once and for all thing. It can't be a once and for all thing because as you go along, you discover more deeply what it is you're committing to. You don't really know what it means to be a Buddhist at the beginning or the middle or even the end, in a sense, because you're always rediscovering that on a deeper level, and it's got to be like that. If you knew what it was, well, it wouldn't have that quality of self-transcendence. The ideal itself, by its nature, has to be something beyond yourself now, yes.
Is that not a danger in the whole, like, chasing enlightenment thing? Like, I find, like, when are you ever there? Like, when do you know you're there? And it's always like you've got to keep,
yeah.
You know, I'll be enlightened when I do this, and it'll be okay when I do that. But I think this is the danger in this.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah.
From what I've experienced so far.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
it's never really done. I've got to do this, and then I'll be cool, and then I'll do that.
Yeah.
The street, you know, go do whatever it may be. It seems,
yeah. Well, you see.
You feel content with your current state of being.
So that's good, isn't it? It's because both are true. That it's never done. Yeah. It's never done. But at the same time, one has to sort of also rest in receptivity. So if you're chasing it, you're in that, as long as you're chasing, you're in that sort of cyclic mode.
So when you're chasing, you'll never get it, basically. You just won't know when it's happened.
Right.
It just
okay.
But
that's the thing, isn't it? I think the key is in that phrase you said, if you don't chase it, you won't get it. Because, and that's why I think something like aesthetic experience is the closest analogy that one has to what we're talking about. Because it's a bit like, aesthetic experience can't be done by willpower. So say you're trying to write a poem or something, or paint a picture, or even have a meaningful conversation with someone. You can't do that by willpower. You can't do that by chasing it. You can only set up the conditions for it, yeah? At the same time, you can't ever say it's done. In terms of, well, I mean, an individual thing could be done, but you can't ever say that your creative process, like a poet would never say, oh, well, that's me done. You know, that's me written everything I'm ever going to write and I'm done.
Yeah, looking at it from that point of view, it does make sense, because I'm actually a musician by trade, and I find, like, we're the same, we never think we're done, we've never learnt enough, it's never complete,
yeah.
And I think that's the beauty of it.
Yeah.
So maybe if I look at it from that point of view, then it's actually a good thing.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So that, and I think you've said it very well, that's the beauty of it.
Yeah.
The beauty of it is never done. So that's a, you can, well, just when you said it, that expresses the creativity of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? So, but, and that's very different from the mode of chasing something. At the same time, one is, well, you know, presumably as a musician, you're learning, you're practicing, you're not just sitting waiting for it to happen passively, but at the same time, you can't, it's like that thing, you can't make the lightning strike. Yeah. So Lucy, did Lucy have something, Jo?
Yeah, I think it's just that the minute I find that I'm focused on an end result, it's almost like an ego thing again, like it's this sort of idea of possibly, like, you know, it's the superego, when I'm enlightened, this is what I'll be like, or now I meditate, this is who I am, it becomes a new ID. And I think that it's just about sitting back for me and enjoying and realising that the journey is the end result and enjoying the process just as much as you enjoy making music. It's like, it doesn't work out sometimes it feels you know, like you're not going to get there. But I don't know, it's just embracing, having compassion for the times when it does feel difficult or close,
yeah,
in terms of being with suffering and having that compassion,
yeah,
to, because I think I find that I've become, I relate to what you're saying. I think it's not that you're addicted to meditation, but I'm sensitive now. So for example, if I haven't been with nature,
yeah,
or I feel more sensitive, like you said, when you're away from it.
Yeah. I think that's again, the thing, there's almost like two points you're saying, because I think yes, and so yes, one can think, oh, the journey is it, and yes, that's not untrue, but at the same time, you've still got something held up before you, that's giving your journey some focus. Maybe that's a way to say it, and that's important, and it's important that something represented by the three jewels is something that's constantly transcending, because then it will be always drawing you on. So on one hand, I think you're right, as soon as you start thinking, oh yeah, when I'm this I'll be great, and then you are just creating a bigger and bigger me. And that's the central problem of like any spiritual life, is how you don't just appropriate more and more to yourself. And well, that's the classic dilemma that any not just Dharma practitioners, but I'm sure any practitioners will always have. How am I making sure that I'm not just appropriating more and more to myself? One's always got to be addressing that. And a kind of potent way of doing that is serving something that's beyond yourself. And you've probably all had glimpses of, in doing that, they can be moments, or even more moments of, well, that kind of positive self-forgetfulness. Like, you know, it can be in quite small ways. If a friend's ill or something, and you just, you know, that move, oh, I want to help them. In that moment, you're not thinking, oh, look at me, I'm brilliant. I mean, that might kick in later, and often does. We're sort of, we go up that spiral a bit, and then we're pulled down again. But in, you know, we probably all have moments where we're just, you know, we're just moved to help, or we're just moved by beauty, and all that drops away. We're drawn out of ourselves, and that's us. That's something more like truly going for refuge. And then, yeah, we'll kind of slide back down the spiral onto this more horizontal plane. But the thing to leave you with is just a reminder that if we keep practicing in that way, that's more and more open, more and more going for refuges, to the true refuges, to what really has value, that there does come a point in our Dharma life where that momentum is such that we no longer fall back down again. That momentum is such that we can only go up, as it were, more and more that spiral. And that's, you know, that's that's definitely, according to the Dharma, that definitely is true. You know, if we believe what the Dharma says, but even we can get, you know, we can imagine that in our own experience, that there will come a point where the momentum is such that there's only spiral movement, that there's no longer that sort of ricocheting pleasure pain thing.
That ascension of the spiral, though, is the only thing that's sometimes giving me heart.
Yeah.
Because it's this idea that when you fall back, you know you haven't fallen back as far.
Well, hopefully not.
You know, you haven't, but that visual.
Hopefully not. If you keep practicing, you won't. Yeah. Yeah, if you keep practicing, you won't. I'm sure you haven't, Lucy. Sometimes I think I have to. But if you keep practicing, there'll be more of a momentum towards that spiral. Okay, we better leave it there. But thank you for the discussion. And next week we'll have Jnana Bhaksha. Thanks.